Our next case is 18-1067 Bill Barrett Corporation versus YMC Royalty. And Ms. Peters, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Lynn Peters and I am here today on behalf of the appellants who I will collectively refer to as YMC. Today we're here to ask you to reverse the orders of the trial court basically for two critical errors. The first of which is, in our view, we submit the law is that an authority for expenditure, commonly known as an AFE in the oil and gas industry, is never a binding contract. And we believe this court should follow the Fifth Circuit and make that the clear precedent in the Tenth Circuit as well. In addition, we believe the trial court's exclusion of YMC's expert witness, particularly Mr. Feuerstein, who was excluded at trial, and the manner in which he was excluded from testifying as an expert at trial, resulted in an unfair situation and prejudiced YMC's ability to present its case to the jury. Therefore, even if you do not follow suit with the Fifth Circuit on the AFE issue, we believe you should remand for a new trial.
Now, there were a couple documents here that were exchanged and apparently approved. What is missing from those two documents to make this a binding contract?
Well, so the documents here that BBC relied upon in trying to say that the AFE was a contract was the AFE itself and a cover letter that went with it. And that cover letter essentially says what the Colorado pooling statute requires that every mineral owner get before a pooling order can enter. You have the ability to lease with us, or you may participate, and here's the AFE, the estimate of our expenses. Check a box and tell us which way you would like to consider going with us, and then you return the forms. But that letter specifically says, if you choose to lease, we will send you a lease agreement to be executed and signed, and then you're bound as a lease. You've leased your interest to us. If you choose to participate, sign the AFE, and we'll send you a joint operating agreement to be negotiated and signed.
So there might be more in a joint in a operating agreement to be signed, but when it's a working interest, what do you need to know besides the percentage? Because that tells you that what you're going to get paid and what you're going to have to pay, does it not? What more is needed?
Well, so what's missing in the cover letter in this AFE is, when do you get paid? When are you required to make payment? Do you make payment all at once, or can you make it over time? What gets to be included in those costs? In addition to the estimated cost, can you include overhead in that? What happens if I don't make payment? How are those expenses recouped? There's a whole host of things for this type of working interest joint operation that is not included in just this tell me which direction you'd like to pursue type of letter and estimate that was sent out in this particular case to the mineral owners. And it's important to keep in mind that this goes to every mineral owner. This is not as if they're only offering other oil and gas companies the chance to participate as a working interest owner. They're required by Colorado law to make that proposal to every mineral owner, whether it's a grandchild who just inherited mineral interests they don't even know, didn't know existed and don't know what they mean, whether it's a farmer who happened to acquire it when they bought their land, or another oil and gas company who acquired a mineral interest. And those individuals aren't going to appreciate that just getting an estimate and saying, I'd like to pursue maybe participating with you and I'll review your joint operating agreement means, well, whether or not we sign that joint operating agreement, you're now bound to pay your share of these millions of dollars in expenses because you signed an AFE and sent it back to me. That, to me, is the problem here with saying just a cover letter giving you that option to check a box and pick a path that you want to pursue, and signing a document that essentially is your acknowledgement you were given an estimate so that the operator has complied with the pooling statute is enough to bind you.
We don't have an underlying lease here, do we? We don't have an underlying lease agreement.
No, there was no lease agreement here between, YMC chose to pursue the path of a participation. They said, look, we'd like to see the joint operation agreement. We'd like to agree on that. This is a case.
Well, Barron sent your clients hundreds of thousands of dollars in revenue checks and you cashed them. What, if there was no deal, what was the basis for you accepting those payments?
Well, the payments are an interesting point. So in total, Bill Barrett paid YMC $148,000 because of an accounting error. They put him in pay status when they claimed they shouldn't have. But under the law, and had they reached this agreement, had they been a working interest and signed up and signed an operating agreement, they would not have been entitled to be paid until all the costs had been paid from the revenues. That's the way Bill Barrett's expert and its own witnesses testified they did business. And so the fact that Bill Barrett was making payment is more consistent with what happens when you're a non-consenting owner. You haven't signed a lease. You haven't signed an operating agreement to be a participant in the well. You are then pooled as a non-consenting owner. And as a non-consenting owner under the statute, you're entitled to your statutory royalty, and then you don't get any additional share of revenue in the well unless and until 200% of the costs are recouped by the operator. So the fact that they were being paid.
Did your client when they received the first payment, did your client take any steps to confirm with Barrett that there was no contract?
My recollection, I don't believe it was prompted by payment, but there is a series of email communications and phone calls that happened between the parties where YMC was throughout that time period saying, where are you on our comments to the joint operating agreement? So a joint operating agreement was provided here. It was redlined, and a couple of drafts were exchanged between the parties. And then at some point, Bill Barrett just stopped responding to YMC's requests about where are we on getting this operating agreement.
Just so I understand, so your client took the position that the circumstances defaulted to a lease agreement situation, and the payments they received were in essence royalty payments?
The statutory royalty. So under Colorado's pooling statute, which is CRS 3460.116, what happens if you don't lease and you do not agree to participate? You are then a non-consenting owner. And the statute provides, essentially the statute imposes a lease term upon you that entitles you to be paid a 12.5% royalty, I believe is the current amount, until 200% of the costs are paid, and then you're paid whatever your share of the excess revenues would be. Now here, of course, there weren't excess revenues, because even before this proposal was sent out to YMC and other mineral owners, Bill Barrett had already drilled this well. It had already completed it. This was not an estimate of future drilling, as is typically the case when you send an AFE. They had already drilled it and didn't bother to tell anybody that. And we submitted and submitted testimony that they knew the well was not producing, and we're looking for a way to try to bind somebody to help share these costs.
Was there nothing on the documents that they paid your client, or that indicated that it was not royalty?
My recollection is that those documents, like the AFE and like the division order and the pooling declaration documents in the record, all described it as a working interest. But that's the term you use for a non-consenting owner as well. They're also described as a working interest. So I don't know that the documents themselves put our clients on notice one way or the other. It's our position that it doesn't matter. Whether they were paid in error or not is not proof of whether or not they had reached agreement to share, whether or not signing off on the AFE here in response to a cover letter that said, sign the AFE and we'll agree to negotiate and sign an operating agreement. At what point are you actually
That sounds odd to me, that a statutory royalty holder is deemed to be a working interest?
Well, I think they're all considered working interest at that point. It's just whether you're a consenting working interest owner or a non-consenting working interest owner. But I think the terminology could be the same. The other thing
I want to understand this, because I hadn't appreciated this from the briefs.
Sure.
So how are you treated differently as a non-consenting working interest owner?
So this is, as a non-consenting working interest owner, you are entitled to your statutory royalty, but you have to, the operator is entitled to recoup not just their actual costs of the well, but 200% of the cost of the well. So there's a penalty imposed upon you for not consenting. That's essentially double the cost of the well that they recoup.
And you will get no royalties until the owner has recouped 200%.
Well, that's an interesting distinction in the statute. So you're actually entitled to your statutory 12.5% royalty. You just, if for instance you own 20% of an interest, you only get a 12.5% royalty until all those costs, the 200% of costs, are recovered. and then you recoup. Let's say the well pays out, then you get all the way up to your 20%.
The YMCA, you wouldn't have gotten anything until Barrett had recouped the $5 million cost of the well, would it?
I think that would have been the case had they signed an operating agreement, yes. That was the testimony from Bill Barrett's witnesses and its expert that was allowed to testify, that if you had signed an operating agreement and were a consenting working interest owner, no payments would have been made until the costs were
paid.
But
a statutory interest owner would get the 12.5% royalty.
Correct.
From the outset,
correct.
You're saying.
Yes, okay. And that's what's set forth in that pooling statute, that's whether it's in 3460.116, which defines what information an owner has to get as part of the pooling process. That same statutory scheme details out the payments if you're consenting versus non-consenting.
Barrett also put up a witness that testified that it was custom and practice in the industry that these documents could establish a meeting of the minds. Do we have to defer to that as a factual determination by the jury, or are you saying that regardless of any of Mr. Stahl's testimony, that as a matter of law, these documents are inadequate?
So my answer to that is twofold. One is, it's our position that as a matter of law, these documents on their own should never and are never enough to form a binding agreement. That's the position taken by the Fifth Circuit in the Sonnet case. And Sonnet,
so we would disagree. We would disregard their expert's testimony in toto.
Correct. Because we think as a matter of law, it should never have gotten to the jury. These documents, as they were examined in the Sonnet case by the Fifth Circuit, in that case in particular, the AFE had even more language in it than we have here. It actually said, when you signed it, it said, we accept and agree. There's no such language here. When you look at, for instance, Trial Exhibit P42, there's no language that says we accept and agree to these costs. They signed off and said, all right, we check your box, send us a joint operating agreement, and we acknowledge and approve that we received an AFE. That's all we have here. And so to us, this is exactly the case that the Fifth Circuit had in front of Sonnet, and this court should follow suit and say, these are never enough. And part of the reason for that is, again, we're talking about every mineral owner is affected by these AFEs. And what you decide here on that issue is going to impact mineral owners who operate as YMC did in other states. There was testimony from the general counsel or associate general counsel for BBC, Ms. Stolt, who also said it was custom in Texas that you have to have a joint operating agreement. And YMC, of course, came to this deal familiar with the custom and practice in Texas. So that's what they brought to the table, and that's also why we've taken the position here that there could not have been a meeting of the minds based on industry and custom when the two parties coming to the table have different understandings of what that custom was. And mineral owners across the board, especially those who are inheriting from grandparents or those who are coming to the table as not an oil and gas industry person, aren't going to have any understanding of what that industry action is. And Bill Barrett here as an operator, remember, has the ability to put themselves in a position to protect themselves by adding very clear language. If they want to have an agreement right up front, they can clearly do that by sending the joint operating agreement and saying, sign our joint operating agreement, sign a short version of an operating agreement, send it back. They didn't do that here. I would also point the court to, and I want to jump quickly to the expert issue as well, but the least distinction between what was offered in Exhibit P42, which is the offer letter that came with the AFE, in the lease part they say, we offer to lease at a specific royalty rate for a specific term of 3 years and at a specific bonus payment of $500 per acre. If you want to do that, let us know. We'll send you a lease agreement to sign. But all the witnesses testified that even if they checked the box and signed the letter saying we want a lease, that is not binding to have a lease until they sign the lease agreement. And all we're saying here is the same must be true when you're looking at the operating agreement piece. And then lastly, this exclusion of Mr. Furstein is important because he was the only other witness who was going to testify in contradiction to Mr. Stahl, who was allowed to testify about industry custom and practice in Colorado. And Mr. Furstein would have testified that what Mr. Stahl said about joint operating agreements was not correct, and that it is in fact customary in Colorado that you do take that additional step, because you're talking about doing business over millions of dollars that people aren't going to do just on saying, all right, I acknowledge this estimate, but I have no idea if I'm ultimately agreeing
right.
to pay I,
but
just
he didn't,
that
he didn't
or
testify.
More.
He was bumped on the kind of Daubert step one. And what was the district court's abuse of discretion on the excluding Mr. Feuerstein?
Well, I think that's 2 points. The most egregious part here, I think, is in the manner in which the trial judge ruled and what he told the jury. In ruling that
that's a separate, in my mind. The first issue is, was the Daubert ruling an abuse of discretion? The second one would be the district court's additional statements in front of the jury, whether that was grounds for a mistrial. So my question was as to the first.
Well, I do think it's an abuse of discretion because the only reason he excluded Mr. Feuerstein was because he was a lawyer and because he found he wasn't qualified to give the statements. And that was, I believe, the pretrial ruling. That's the only statement there.
Why was that?
Because here we're talking about somebody
with... Why was that error?
Because here it's directly contrary and not supported by the facts. Mr. Feuerstein has 37 years of experience. He'd negotiated between 10 and 50 joint operating agreements. And while he was a lawyer, that doesn't mean he doesn't know the industry within which he practices. And so it's our position that it was an abuse of discretion on Judge Ebel's part at trial to have excluded Mr. Feuerstein, and at the same time by telling the jury not once, not twice, but 4 times when you take the curative instruction in place that he shouldn't be able to testify because it won't be helpful because you've already heard enough. Yeah, you don't need this.
Sure.
And I am over time now, so.
I know you're over, but he has additional questions.
So pretrial, Judge Jackson.
Correct.
Said he wasn't going to let Mr. Feuerstein testify about what the law is, and said, but he can testify about practice. He didn't exclude that. At trial, Judge Ebel did exclude testimony about practice. I did not see anything in your brief challenging that ruling by Judge Ebel. You complained about his having the Daubert hearing in front of the jury and commenting to the jury, but I didn't see any challenge to the substantive ruling by Judge Ebel to the extent he went beyond Judge Jackson's ruling.
I believe the challenge was, if you look at, in our brief, was we said we had a witness who was eminently qualified, and Judge Ebel's ruling that he wasn't isn't supported by the evidence. It's a very short argument. But the totality here of what Judge Ebel did, I get, he walked through...
We're over time, so I want to focus on the one thing that the things that concern me most, if that's all right with you. Mm-hmm. So your only challenge was that brief sentence saying your expert was eminently qualified. Am I correct?
I'd have to go back to the briefs directly. Okay. It was all, you are correct, our argument was all wrapped together with regard to Judge Ebel, but it's my position and our belief that we did challenge the qualification finding.
Was there a proffer? Because the other thing you don't say in your brief is what Mr. Feuerstein would have said that was contrary to the expert for YMC.
Mr. Stahl. There was a proffer made at the time.
But you don't discuss that in your brief.
Yeah, there was a proffer made at the time. And I believe in our reply brief, we do discuss a few of the points that Mr. Feuerstein would, I believe we discuss at least one point Mr. Feuerstein would have said that was different, which would have been the disagreement about joint operating agreements.
Your burden is to do that in your opening brief.
There is a proffer in the record, I would say, in response to the voir dire argument and objections that were made. There was an interaction in which an offer of proof was made at that time.
Thank you, counsel. Your time's expired. Mr. Glenn for Barrett.
Mr. Chief Judge, and may it please the court, I'm Andrew Glenn, representing the appellee, High Point Operating Corporation, formerly Bill Barrett Corporation. With me at counsel's table is my co-counsel, Karen Spaulding. I'd like to begin with addressing YMC's assertion that it preserved a challenge to Judge Ebel's decision to exclude Randall Feuerstein as an expert witness. As Judge Hartz pointed out, nowhere in the opening brief does YMC do anything that would be considered complying with Federal Rule of Appellate Procedure 28, which requires an appellant in its opening brief to identify the problematic decision, explain why that decision is wrong with argument and citation to legal authorities. YMC's brief contains none of that. In fact, most of the portions of the brief, pages 19 through 26, that they point you to in the reply brief, are dedicated to arguing that Judge Ebel abused his discretion in commenting on the evidence, which, as Judge Timkovich pointed out, being a separate issue from the abuse of discretion standard, that would apply in the context of excluding an expert witness. Further, most of their argument is then dedicated to arguing that Judge Jackson failed to perform his gatekeeping function at the outset.
So you're saying even in the reply brief, they did not indicate exactly what Mr. Furstein would testify to that had, would be different than Mr. Stahl or in addition to Mr. Stahl?
I believe that they testified or they identified that Mr. Furstein would provide different testimony, but they don't argue how Judge Jackson abused his discretion, or excuse me, Judge Ebell, abused his discretion in the opening brief or really in the reply brief as required under the Daubert standard. And I'd like to make another point that Judge Ebell didn't just exclude Furstein on the helpfulness prong of the Rule 702 analysis. He went through all four factors and excluded Furstein on the basis of each one. And each one of those factors must be shown in order for a witness to testify as an expert. And because YMC doesn't even raise, even today, a challenge to, for example, any of the reliability considerations with respect to the admission of an expert witness, whether Judge Ebell did in fact err, which we maintain he did not, but did in fact err on the helpfulness prong, they still don't make any challenge to the other bases on which Judge Ebell could have excluded Furstein properly under Rule 702.
You know, it seems what bothers me is I'm not bothered that he did a, you know, Daubert hearing in front of the jury. I think the cases permit that, but it seems like given the status of the experts after Judge Jackson dealt with it, that YMC really got sandbagged with its expert proffer at trial. And, you know, if it had a kind of a proper Daubert hearing ahead of time, it would have known that, you know, maybe one of its other expert witnesses should have been available to testify about custom practice. And it's a little unclear why Mr. Furstein wouldn't have been as qualified as Mr. Stahl would to make the industry custom. And, you know, how is Furstein an inferior expert by qualification than Mr. Stahl was?
I'll take the latter part of that question first.
Yeah, it was a jumbled mess, but I think you get my sense.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Furstein is a title attorney who focuses almost exclusively on issues related to land use as opposed to development.
Right, but he negotiated up to 50 joint operating agreements.
Well,
wouldn't somebody that did that know industry custom and practice?
I think, one, Your Honor, it is up to the judge sitting at trial to determine whether, based on the testimony that's being received and the evidence before the court, to make a determination as to whether or not Furstein has those qualifications. And while Mr. Furstein may have testified that he has done somewhere between 10 to 50 joint operating agreements, although he could not be sure, that the other testimony that was elicited both through the voir dire as well as YMC supplemental questioning of Mr. Furstein regarding, for example, his testimony before the General Assembly, which had nothing to do with oil and gas issues, his articles, which also did not relate to the use of joint operating agreements or custom and practice in that regard, that Mr. Furstein, as held by Judge Ebell, and I do not believe this was abuse of discretion, that his experience did not differentiate him from any other attorney who may just be practicing law in the state of Colorado, and that did not rise to the level sufficient in order to establish that he was capable of testifying as an expert witness.
But if we disagree with you on that point, wouldn't that be reversible error on the contract formation claim?
It would not.
Because YMCA would not have had an opportunity to rebut Barrett's testimony.
Judge Ebell's decision, as I just explained, involved four different explanations for why Mr. Furstein should not be permitted to testify. If, for example, the court were to disagree that Judge Ebell was wrong in concluding that Furstein had qualifications, the court would still need to go through the other three explanations that Judge Ebell gave as to why he was he should not be permitted to testify under Rule 702. Rule 702 requires that each one of those factors be satisfied. And because YMC does not challenge any of those on appeal, That alone precludes the court from finding ultimately a reversible error on the abuse of discretion point. But I also do not believe that Judge Ebell abused his discretion. His decision is not arbitrary or capricious, nor did it exceed the reasonable grounds of options for choice in this context. But as I said, YMC hasn't preserved that issue in its opening brief. While they, as explained in Nixon v. City of Denver, 784 F3D 1364, a single conclusory assertion that the district court erred is not sufficient to preserve an issue under Rule 28. And that's all YMC has offered today, is a single assertion of conclusory error. Right. They can sit there and they can explain certain facts or his background, but if you don't make the argument, you don't explain why the decision is wrong, they've not satisfied their burden as an appellant to preserve an issue in the opening brief.
Let me go to the contract formation issue then. Counsel made an interesting argument that there was nothing to indicate that this was anything other than a statutory working interest, given all the things that were left to be agreed upon by a more formal agreement, and the fact that there is a statutory backup provision, and there was no reason for the recipient of the money to think that that wasn't why they were getting the money. One of the arguments was that I thought was being made is they're getting this money, surely they knew that they had agreed to a working interest or they wouldn't have been getting this. You heard her argument. Would you respond to it? But I have some concerns I'd like you to.
Yes, Your Honor. First, in order for a party to be a non-consenting owner that is pooled under the Oil and Gas Conservation Act, they need to be pooled. And the evidence in this case was submitted that YMC was not actually listed as any of the parties that had elected not to consent. So there wouldn't have been any reason for YMC, a company that is as experienced as it is in the oil and gas business, to believe that even though it consented to participate in the oil and gas venture, that it was somehow still rendered a non-consenting working interest owner. But I think that raises the more important point, which relates to YMC's contention over what the Fifth Circuit held in Sonat, as well as what the evidence shows with respect to the terms, the existence of mutual assent in the contracts themselves, and the parties' course of performance. First, Sonat found that the AFE at issue in that case was insufficient because it lacked a promise to pay. In fact, it tried to find industry custom and practice that would support the existence of an AFE being enforceable without the presence of a JOA. But there was no evidence submitted in that case on that issue. On both counts, this case is distinguishable. First, Riemann testified, as well as the terms of the contract containing this, that his understanding, and he executed the contracts on behalf of YMC, that each proposal letter from both wells was soliciting YMC's agreement to pay its share of the costs. The industry custom and practice testimony, as well as the testimony of Bill Barrett's witnesses, is that that's typically what these letters contain and provide for, and that he understood that YMC had to agree to pay its share of the costs before any discussion about a JOA would occur. And that's more explained in detail on pages 16 through 31 of the response brief. But what you have there is, and I'll also add that Riemann testified, contrary to the assertions of YMC, that he understood that multiple parties could participate in a well without a joint operating agreement. So on those facts, what you have at the very least is a conflict regarding the formation of a contract that under Colorado law must be submitted to the jury for its determination. But in addition to the terms...
Is there a legal issue regarding whether there's been enough agreement? You wouldn't give it to the jury, or you shouldn't give it to the jury, if a price term wasn't in the contract, unless there's some experience between the parties or some way that you could reasonably construe what the price term should be. But here there are a lot of things that are not in these documents. Do you dispute her statement about the various things that were not stated in the document, such as when payment would be and so on?
There is no specific statement in the documents regarding when payment should be made. But I'd like to first take the point that the terms themselves, the contracts, for example, the 1121, this is the only contract we're discussing right now, contain sufficient terms for this court to know whether or not it's been performed. The offer says we're soliciting YMC's agreement to participate by paying its share of the costs. Riemann testified he understood that that's exactly that BBC was soliciting YMC's agreement to pay its share of the costs, and that he understood the process through which he could accept that offer. He also testified that he unequivocally accepted that offer and did not condition it upon the execution of a JOA. So on those facts, you have mutual promises of payment, you have the consideration, but the court can make a determination, as required by Colorado law, as to whether or not this contract has been performed. But of course, as you point out, Your Honor, Colorado law will not require a contract to fail if missing terms can be supplied by industry custom and practice. And with respect to order of payment, there was industry custom and practice by Melstal, as identified in the response brief, that typically you pay your costs and you receive your share of the payment. It provides for a sort of standard monthly billing process for that to occur.
And that was testified to by your expert?
It was, Your Honor. But I think the issue there is that because there's mutual promises of payment, you have the ability to determine whether or not the contract has been performed. Okay, you have Bill Barrett's agreement that it's going to drill and operate the wells, and YMC's agreement that it's going to pay its share of the costs in exchange for receiving a larger share of the revenues from those wells. And that's what the course of performance evidence demonstrates in this case, because in May of 2013, YMC's internal email correspondence attributes it as owning a working interest in both wells. It identifies the day those wells were drilled, but YMC did not raise an issue regarding whether or not a contract had been performed. Instead, they would go on to execute division orders in August of 2013, reaffirming their ownership of a working interest, which Riemann testified is a cost-bearing interest in a well, and that he would not have signed those division orders if Bill Barrett incorrectly attributed it with a working interest, which it would have been different on the AF, I believe it would have been different on the division order. But they would sign those division orders. They would receive $148,000 in payment. They would receive revenue statements from Bill Barrett attributing YMC as owning a working interest. And YMC counsel alluded to conversations, email exchanges between Bill Barrett and YMC. And in particular, there's testimony from Bill Barrett's witness, Ms. Kibby Wilson, who stated that after a conversation with Riemann, she started sending, at his request, bills and an additional revenue statement showing what it was owed if it were to start paying its costs. Well, at that point, go ahead.
Did I misunderstand that the well had been drilled and was dry before these documents were sent out?
No, Your Honor, that is contradicted by the record. First, the evidence submitted, which is there's a COGCC production tally, monthly production tally, that shows that in the first initial 5 or 6 months of the well, you could not determine whether or not it was dry. It was still producing. And it wouldn't be until after YMC was capable of seeing all of that information publicly available that it became clear that the well itself was not going to be that productive. But there is also evidence that YMC knew the well was drilled at the time it executed those contracts. Why? Because the 1121 contract states that Bill Barrett had already drilled the well. They're a sophisticated operator. They read the contracts. They had to sign the AFE and the cover letter. But all of this creates a factual conflict regarding the existence of a contract that under Colorado law could be resolved using reasonable inferences in favor of Bill Barrett.
Any additional questions? Thank you, counsel. Your time's expired.
Thank you.
Counsel shall be excused and the case submitted. Appreciate the arguments.